Okay, I think we're going to begin. So I'm going to call the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order. And today, members, we're going to hear two bills. But before that, we have a presentation by DHS in the Children and Family Services. So we're going to hear about the great things we all did last year, especially investments we made in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. This program, referred to as MFIP, I'm sure many of you are familiar, but it's a program that was created as a result of the welfare reforms at the federal level that were made in the 90s, where we moved from the aid to families with dependent children to a block grant program called TANF, for Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. And this is a program that's jointly funded by the states and the federal government. And the families qualify, they're low income. I think like a family of three would be making $20,000 or less, and would be receiving, if family members didn't work, around $1,000. So this program, we made the first time a cost of living adjustment to account for inflation, and we also increased a one-time payment of around $400 during COVID. So we're going to learn about that program and those updates, and updates we made in housing and emergency services for homelessness and child welfare. And then we'll talk about the two bills that probably won't take a lot of time for discussions. We might end early today. But before we do that, we're going to take the roll. Ms. Hansen?
Yes, good morning. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner? I see you. Lead Albright?
Morning.
Good morning. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, present.
Representative Burkle?
Burkle, present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Good morning. Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Noor? Representative Novotny?
Novotny, present.
Representative Pearson? Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members.
Great, we have a quorum. See, Representative Albright, would you like to move the minutes from February 16th?
Madam Chair, I've reviewed them and I find them approved as written, and I move them.
Thank you for that motion. Any corrections or discussion of the minutes? Not seeing any. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Okay, members, hopefully you got a chance to look at all of the redistricting maps, and now that is behind us and we can focus on the committee material that we have before us. So first we have a presentation from DHS, and I believe we have Deborah Schlick. There you are, Deborah. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Representative Schultz and committee. I'm Deborah Schlick. I work in the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division of DHS. I'm going to start this presentation because the update's going to start with policy changes the legislature made in the economic assistance area. But my colleagues from Children and Family Services will then take over to explain child safety and permanency and child support changes. So we have a number of things that the legislature did with our program, so begin on those. One of the significant ones was the legislature allocated a one-time $435 COVID relief payment to the families who receive MFIP assistance. So the 28,000 families receiving MFIP assistance in October 2021 received that one-time payment. The other thing the legislature did with benefits was reintroduce an annual cost of living adjustment for those benefits. There had been no cost of living adjustment in place since 1986. And that so that first adjustment was 1.4%, and it was made on October 1st. Last fall. The annual adjustments will always be made on October 1st, the start of the federal fiscal year. Next slide, please. You passed two laws to allow more access by phone. The first for families in the Minnesota Family Investment Program is the opportunity, if necessary, to submit an application, to do an interview, and to be oriented to the Minnesota Family Investment Program by phone instead of just in person or by video teleconference. That was implemented September 1st. If someone submits an application by phone, they call in, they answer all the questions, the worker fills it out, then that application is mailed to them. They have to sign and attest to the verification of the information and have that back in within 30 days in order to actually receive benefits. The other change you made was allowing when people submit monthly household report forms. The law had previously said if something was missing or unclear on that form, it had to be mailed back to the person, the form revised, and then mailed back to the worker. Now workers can make a phone call to say, it seems like you skipped a question or I don't understand what you answered here. And that change was implemented July 1st. Next, please. The legislature changed some of the means by which we treat income for self-employed individuals who are receiving cash assistance. That will go into effect May 1st, 2022. We've begun developing the guidance so we can have it out to county and tribal offices in time. The main changes you made were one that if someone is paying personal expenses out of what's designated as a business account, then we're going to treat that business account as a personal asset and we'll ask for reporting on it as a personal account. And the way we treat the tax treatment of self-employed income for cash assistance now lines up with the federal SNAP processes for interpreting that tax information. Then you provided some significant funding to help the state work with counties and tribes to reduce errors in the SNAP program. The SNAP error rate is an important measure of customer service that the federal government holds states to. And if we don't hit a target, we can be subject to penalty. The target changes every year because it's based on the error rate across the nation, but our goal is to be below a 6% error rate, and then we think we'll be safe. So with the $1.4 million you provided for 2022 and 2023 and the $1.2 million for 2024 and 2025, the department has hired 3 of 5 new staff positions. The hiring's underway for the final two. That staff has begun work on finalizing a new case review tool that allows local county and tribal agencies to do some of their own quality assurance work, not just the quality assurance case reviews that the state does. We've begun expanded training for local staff where there are some common errors that are seen and are providing technical assistance to counties and tribes who are under corrective action plans. And the staff have begun looking at which policies and procedures are affiliated with the most frequent errors to then to build plans to how to reduce those frequent patterns. There was a complicated piece of statute that really just helped us clean up discrepancies between the statute 256J that governs the Minnesota Family Investment Program and 256P, a fairly recent chapter that came into being in 2014. 256P is where the legislature has been putting statute that governs across public assistance programs. It's part of a multi-year effort that counties have been seeking to get more uniform policies across public assistance programs. But in the original drafting, when that was a new statute. There were discrepancies and contradictions between 256J and 256P. So you cleaned up many of those last session. So now the manuals and the materials that department provides to local offices have been reviewed and make sure that they're consistent with the clear interpretation of the law. There were two pieces of legislation that you passed to ensure that tribes were getting equitable access to resources. The first was to allow tribes to apply for food shelf funding, not just counting agencies or local nonprofits. So two tribes, Boys Fort Band of Chippewa and the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, applied and received funding in the fall RFP. We're expecting more tribes to apply and receive funding in future RFPs to run food shelves. The other change was that White Earth Nation has led the way a few years ago. They took on the authority and capacity to administer public assistance benefits for tribal members. And the law was confusing and ambiguous about whether a tribe doing eligibility work could also administer administer emergency assistance to its members. So you clarified the law last year that they can do so, and White Earth Nation is administering emergency assistance to its members. Other tribes now will also have that capacity as they move in that direction. Then in the Community Action Program formula, the funding allocation, you made two changes. You increased the minimum allocation a local community action agency could receive from $25,000 to $50,000. This primarily affected tribes who are getting the minimal allocations, and you increased the funding available to community action agencies by $1 million. Both those changes have been made in the contracts that are now in place in 2022. We also changed law for how cash assistance treats unemployment insurance for high school students. This was to align with a law change in the unemployment insurance program, which was made last session, which recognized that high school students who are working and lose a job through no fault of their own are eligible for unemployment insurance. The change in our program law was that since we do not count earned income, if a high school student in a family receiving cash assistance is working, that we would not count the unemployment insurance benefits that that student, as long as they're attending school, receives. And that went into effect on June 30th. And then finally, you did three things to address homelessness. You provided $2 million that would be available to homeless shelters to do renovation funding for safety or expansion efforts. That was put out in an RFP in November. Applications have been submitted and are being reviewed. You also provided an additional $12 million in emergency services program grants. Emergency services program grants go to homeless shelters. That goes to them in a competitive basis. And that RFP is complete, and contracts are being signed with providers so that they'll be receiving that money shortly. And then finally, the legislature directed a different sort of report on homeless youth services. Usually every 2 years, you get a report from us on our grant activities to homeless youth providers. The report that will come in December will be a much larger scan of what are the situations for homeless youth in the state. How many homeless youth are there? What sort of responses are there available? And that builds on a 2007 legislative report that was done on a similar scope. So the work is underway to identify the research agency that will do that report and then contract with them so that they can get that done. That is the end of the update on economic assistance employment supports. I'm going to pass it off to Jamie Sorensen for a report on child safety and permanency.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. So the next presenter is Director Sorensen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jamie Sorensen, Child Safety and Permanency Division Director with Minnesota Department of Human Services. Slide number 12, talking about statutory changes for phase two implementation of Family First Preservation Services Act, FFPSA. New and amended definitions effective July 1st, 2021, qualified individual, Minnesota statutes, section 260C. The definition was amended to identify that tribes may designate qualified individuals who are trained culturally competent professionals or licensed clinicians. Licensed residential family-based substance use disorder treatment program, again, Minnesota statute, section 260C. The definition was amended to include tribally licensed or approved residential substance use disorder treatment programs to those in which children may be co-located with foster care in foster care with their parents. Residential programs, license certifications, Minnesota statute section 245A.25 was added to outline a new set of license certifications for Family First Preservation Services Act. Related requirements effective May 26, 2021, for agencies to claim Title IV-E for children placed in residential settings, residential programs must obtain one of four certifications from the department's licensing division and must be Title IV-E approved by the department's Child Safety and Permanency Division. The new certification types are QRTPs, or Qualified Residential Treatment Programs, facilities for youth at risk of becoming sex trafficked, settings specializing in providing prenatal, postpartum, or parenting supports for youth, and supervised independent living facilities for youth. Juvenile treatment screening team, amendments to Minnesota statute section 260C.157 subdivision 3 went into effect September 30th, 2021, corrects out-of-date terminology and clarifies statute, including language with federal definition of sex trafficked youth, and clarifying that social service agencies must consult with parents regardless of child's age. Qualified Residential Treatment Program, or QRTP assessment, Minnesota statute section 245.4885 subdivision 1 was amended to reduce duplication. The change was effective September 30th, 2021, and permits use of the validated tool to complete as part of the QRTP assessment. Core processes for QRTP placement. Effective September 30th, 2021, multiple modifications made to the court review requirements for QRTP placement. Examples include identify a social service agency, must obtain a judicial finding within 60 days of placement, identifies content of agency's report to the court for placement and qualified residential treatment programs, and a number of other additional modifications and requirements. Aftercare supports. The commissioner is directed to consult with stakeholders to develop policies regarding aftercare supports for transition of children from a QRTP placement to reunification with parent or legal guardian, including potential placement in a less restrictive setting prior to reunification that aligns with children's permanency plans and person-centered support plans when applicable. The commissioner must complete development of the policy guidance by December 31st, 2022, and the work group is scheduled to begin in March of 2022. Moving to slide number 13, number of programs that have become certified QRTPs in Minnesota is 14. Minnesota has 31 children's residential facilities that are already accredited by the national accrediting bodies. The remaining facilities who are seeking national accreditation, the process can take several months. The department provided reimbursement to agencies for costs of accreditation. Those funds were available to those agencies who incurred expenses in the national accreditation process. The department received and funded 7 requests, and each request was between $3,000 and $10,000. Training provided, the department provided numerous trainings on implementation of Family First Prevention Services Act. One of those, FFPSA placement process changes, August 5th, 2021, an overview of changes to residential foster care process for placing agencies. An additional training, QRTP assessment process and qualified individual requirements, provided August 17th, 2021, and an overview of QRTP assessment processes and requirements for qualified individuals. The department also offered guidance and information sessions for DHS and Department of Corrections licensed providers in early 2021 to assist them in understanding the changes in process for certification for QRTPs. They were all well attended, and department staff have additionally issued bulletins, practice guides, and additional program information on Family First. 3 bulletins to highlight: January 20th, 2021, Bulletin 216801 focused on Family First Prevention Services Act, the potential Title IV-E fiscal impact. Second bulletin, March 22, 2021, bulletin number 216810, talked about foster residence settings modification for implementation of Family First, included items such as the MAPC no longer applying to shift staff residential congregate care. And then a third bulletin, June 25th, 2021, bulletin number 216817, focused on Family First Prevention Services Act, the Children's Residential Facilities and Foster Residence Settings Implementation. Moving on to slide number 14, North Star Federal Compliance, effective 8/1/21, eliminates the requirement that DHS automatically offset North Star Adoption Assistance and North Star Kinship Assistance program payments, regardless of whether adoptive parents and relative custodians agree with the payment reduction. Removes the requirement that the negotiation process include consideration of a child's income and resources, and this will place Minnesota statutes in compliance with federal law. This has been implemented, and there is still some work to do in terms of amending existing agreements and implementing the changes in the social service information system. We anticipate those changes to go in effect into rollout 22.2. The federal program improvement plan is completed, and we have to just notify the feds in terms of completion of the amendments. The tribal training and certification partnership establishes an appropriation for the tribal training and certificate partnership with the University of Minnesota Duluth campus through the provision of training, establishment of federal Indian Child Welfare, ICWA, and Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, MIFPA, training requirements for county child welfare workers, and the development of indigenous child welfare training for American Indian tribes in Minnesota. The JPA was fully executed on December 28, 2021, and expires June 30, 2031. The program director, Jerry Jaskin, provided the following information as a status update for her organization's wonderful successes and progress to date. With great respect and honor, I share Ms. Jeskin's information about the work of the TTPC. The Tribal Training and Certificate Program has created, tested, evaluated, and fine-tuned its curriculum for the ICWA-MIFA Child Welfare Worker Foundation's training. The content has been reviewed by county child welfare supervisors, tribal ICWA supervisors, and the ICWA Guardian Ad Litem Program Supervisor. In 2021, this training was provided to 21 cohorts of new child welfare workers and Title IV-E scholars who completed the state's foundation's training. The TTCP has trained a pool of 15 indigenous community trainers, contracted experts representing both tribal and county child welfare workforces with lived and professional experiences. The TTCP is also in the process of onboarding an additional 5 indigenous community trainers to assist with delivering training in 2022. And the TTCP has created a training schedule for the period of January 17th, 2022 to June 30th, 2022, which includes ICWA training for new and ongoing statewide child welfare workers. There are 17 training events, each consisting of 2 full days, averaging 3 ICWA-MIFPA training opportunities per month offered to the statewide child welfare workforce. And then moving to slide number 15, foster care licensing guidance. By July 1, 2023, the Commissioner of Human Services shall, in consultation with stakeholders with expertise in child protection and children's behavioral health, develop family foster setting licensing guidelines for county agencies and private agencies that perform licensing functions. The department, CSP and licensing, are currently in the hiring process for two temporary positions to assist with this work. Reporting substance use in pregnant women, effective July 1, 2021, a healthcare professional is not required to report substance use by pregnant women if the mandated reporter is collaborating with other healthcare professionals to provide the mother with care. A bulletin that was released in November 3rd, 2021, that was providing an overview of the 2021 child welfare legislation was published, and it contained information about this new reporting requirement. CSP is currently working on updating both the mandated reporter guide and the prenatal substance exposure best practice guide. The goal is to have both republished in early quarter two of 2022. And moving to slide number 16, appointment of legal counsel in child protection cases requires a court to appoint counsel to represent a parent, guardian, or custodian who wants and is eligible for appointed counsel for children, child protection proceedings where the child may be removed from the care of the child's parent, guardian, or custodian. It invests $520,000 per year from the general fund for county costs, including administrative costs, to obtain Title IV-E reimbursement. DHS shall distribute to counties based upon their proportional share of emergency protective care hearings averaged over the previous 3 years. Requires DHS to consult with counties and courts on court-appointed counsel data and other implementation efforts, including a distribution formula to begin FY24, and report back when a plan on regular reporting is completed by July 1, 2022. The division continues to work with external partners toward capturing an estimate of statewide expenditures for legal representation, and this support completion when this work is completed, there will be a report submitted. Foster family recruitment and licensing technology requires DHS to publish an RFI to gather information on technology that is available to support foster family recruitment and training through an online portal. DHS shall report to the legislature with RFI responses by January 15th, 2022. The report on the results of the request for information regarding online foster care solution has been completed and submitted. There were 13 responses received. The report provided a high-level summary of the responses. It was submitted to the chairs of the committee in mid-January 2022, and we offered to provide copies of the responses upon request. And why is this report important, and what is the need that we're trying to address? There is a need for additional foster families to be licensed to care for Minnesota's children. Placements with relatives generally appear to be in a child's best interest, and foster care licensing processes must occur in a timely manner for family members. Prospective foster parents are currently burdened with a requirement to search for agencies, place a phone call or send an email, and then wait, sometimes for lengthy periods of time. They often give up during that wait period, and we currently have no tracking capacity for steps and timelines for prospective foster parents. We believe a solution is providing an online foster care licensing recruitment software that could better ensure the availability of licensed foster parents, including relatives, and better match foster parents' specialized skills with the child's individual needs, which in turn improves outcomes. So that completes the child safety and permanency portion of the presentation. And so now I'll pass it over to Tara Borton and let Ms. Borton introduce herself. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Sorensen, for that. The next testifier is Tara Borton, the staff attorney in the Child Support Division. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Tara Borton with DHS Child Support.
So we had a number of pretty exciting changes last year, and we're going to start out with the most significant one, and that is that the legislature approved some recommendations from the Child Support Task Force. So the task force met between 2016 and 2019, and they made the recommendations about the child support guidelines. So the guidelines are what the court actually uses to calculate support when you go to court. The most significant of those changes was changes to the table. So that's where in statute you actually have the dollar amounts written that they use, and that was very old data. So that was updated with the new data, and also there were a lot of changes made at incomes lower than a combined income of $6,000 a month, because we knew that in that area the guidelines were really producing some orders that were too high and that people couldn't pay. There's also going to be a few other changes in the calculation. That's going to include some changes to the way we calculate non-joint children and some changes to the low income adjustment and how we think about how much money a person should have in their home. So we're excited to go and get those changes done. That's going to be effective on January 1st, 2023, and we're working right now on getting the programming changes done to the public calculator, as well as the programming changes that are needed on our internal calculator. And obviously, there's going to be significant public communications and internal training that we're working on with that. The next big change we had was eliminating interest on child support arrears. So currently, when someone is in arrears in any amount, they begin accruing interest on that. The problem with that was we know that that was very harmful, especially for obligors with the highest balances and the least ability to pay. And what we did not have evidence for was that that interest was actually increasing compliance. So the legislature last year got rid of that. That's going to be effective on August the 1st. And again, we're working on a communication about that to parents so that everyone kind of understands what is happening, and that's going to include a letter to parents. Next slide. Another change that's going at the same time as those task force recommendations is changes to credit reporting. The Child Support Division has to report those arrears to credit bureaus when someone is in arrears 3 months, and right now there's really not much out for that. So what the changes are is that there's going to be an ability to enter a payment agreement so that an obligor can come to the county and say, listen, I can pay, let's get on an agreement. And it also allows some more discretion for counties to be able to say, it's not appropriate in this case, we're not gonna send it to the credit bureaus. Because this is changing from an automated process to more of a manual one where we really need child support officers saying, yes, this should go, this is appropriate. We do have a county work group going right now between the county work group and Minute to establish a process and work on what the guidance is going to be for use of that discretion. And the communication and training plan for that is going to happen at the same time as that task force recommendation, since they're effective on January the 1st. Another big change that we had is that Minnesota courts now are allowed to transfer child support cases to tribal courts. This is going to be the child support portions of that, as well as potentially the parenting time and custody portions of that. And it's only going to be for those cases where the tribe is already managing the 4D case. So this really allows parents to handle all of their issues in one court instead of volleying back and forth to a county court and tribal court. This was effective immediately, and the tribes are kind of driving this train. So they have started meeting with the counties, the tribes who are interested in doing this, about moving forward with those cases. There was not a lot of implementation steps necessary at the division. And then the last thing we're going to share today is a small but important change to good cause. There's a referral to child support every time someone receives public assistance, but there's an opportunity for a parent to ask to opt out of those child support services if they feel that they or their child is in danger. That process happens at the county. However, if the county denies it, that parent has a right to appeal. Previously, it happened that the parent had to get some sort of sanction or some sort of negative action on their public assistance case before they had the right to go to the state. So they were really put in an awkward position of having to either put their safety or their benefits at risk. But this change to the law is going to allow them to appeal that decision immediately without waiting for those sanctions to apply on their case. And I think that wraps up our presentation today, and I and my colleagues are available to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Borton. Looks like we have a question from Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. I have a couple of questions for Mr. Sorensen. When a child is assigned to a qualified residential treatment program, how is his or her medical needs taken care of? How is the health care provided?
Director Sorensen, can you answer that question?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, there hasn't been a change in the process for medical assessment and attention to medical needs when a child is placed in a congregate care facility. That practice remains the same, and the department provides guidance on how that medical care is to be attended to when a child is removed from their home and placed in a foster care or congregate care facility. One of the features of QRTP, a requirement, is that they have to have 24-hour nursing staff. And so that is a change in the requirement and certification for a QRTP.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you. A couple follow-ups. One is, how about a child's progress in school, and what's the relationship between the is it QRPT, is that correct, and the and the child's school and educational progress?
Director Sorensen.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. Again, in terms of interaction with school, whether it's an individual education plan or otherwise, the practice remains the same for attending to the child's education. Obviously, if a child is in a foster care setting, more often than not, they're attending school outside of the foster home. Oftentimes in QRTPs or congregate care settings, while there are some youth that attend school off campus, oftentimes school education is provided on-site at the QRTP.
Representative Sandell.
Madam Chair, just one more question. Thanks very much for the presentation to each one of the presenters, but it really is, from my point of view anyway, kind of overwhelming. How many children are affected by all of the work that is being done that we heard about today, and what's the percentage of young men and young women?
Director Sorensen, are you able to answer that question?
Madam Chair, Representative Sandell, annually there's approximately 15,000 children that experience an out-of-home placement episode. Significantly fewer number of those are placements in what we would call a qualified residential treatment program. We also know from our data that there is overrepresentation of American Indian children and children of African heritage in our out-of-home placement settings. And so in Minnesota, it is a significant number of children, and we are very focused on building that infrastructure and those practices that really help kids remain in the home, in the community with their family. We call it family preservation services, but that is really a very big focus of the Family First Preservation Services Act and much of the work that we do with children and families across Minnesota.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you. And just how about the relative occurrence of young men and young women in the program? Is it mostly young men who are part of the program?
Director Sorensen.
Madam Chair, Representative Sandell, I would have to take a look, and we can respond back to you. I believe it is a pretty even split across age groups, but we can take a look and provide that information back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Sorensen. I really appreciate all the work that was presented today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sandell, and thank you to all the presenters. I know all the work our legislators do just puts more work on our agencies, but it's important work, so we appreciate everything you're doing to improve the lives of our Minnesota families. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions for the presenters, so we're going to move on to House File 3269, and I see we have Representative Hansen with us. Representative Hansen, would you like to make the motion to re-refer House File 3269 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, please, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
Okay, that is the motion. I think we have a question. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and I just going back a page, did we properly dispense with the former bill in terms of where it's going, if it's being laid over? I didn't hear that instruction.
I'm sorry, the bill that we're on currently on, House File 3269?
The former, the one that we just completed.
That was just a presentation from DHS, so we did not have a bill before us.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
Yep. We're going to do, after this bill, we'll do the second bill, which is 3259. Okay, sorry about that. Representative Hansen, can you tell us about your bill? And then it looks like we have someone from DHS. Ms. Schlick will answer questions as well. So please proceed, Ms. Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. HF 3269 seeks to further support Minnesota's commitment to data-informed approaches. This is important when we're evaluating and improving our public programs. Currently, DHS collects wage details from DEED to evaluate MFIP, and this bill seeks to allow DHS to use this data to evaluate other public assistance programs too. The data has really strict privacy requirements already, and utilizing this information for MFIP has allowed and empowered DHS to better understand the labor market, the characteristics of people who have utilized these programs. So expanding the usage of this data will promote the utilization of evidence-based methods to evaluate other programs like SNAP, general assistance, supplemental aid, and housing support too. Having a clear understanding of employment patterns with this data allows the state to identify the barriers and the opportunities to ultimately employ the tools necessary to continue to move more families and children out of poverty. So like the chair mentioned, Deborah Schlick with DHS Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division is here with us to answer any technical questions. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. So members, this is a bill that expands some work we did last session. And I'm looking for if anyone has questions for Ms. Schlick about the bill. I'm not seeing any. Any final remarks, Representative Hansen?
Nope, I appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hansen renews her motion to re-refer House File 3269 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee as recommended. This will be a roll call vote. Ms. Hansen? The chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Reed Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Representative Keel, aye.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Liebling, aye.
Oh, Keel, aye. Liebling, aye. Thank you. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Representative Noor. One second. Representative Noor, did you want to cast a vote? I'll circle back. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Representative Sandel?
Aye.
Sandel, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Thank you. Chair Schultz, that's 18 ayes and one excused.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. So the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the Judiciary Committee. Okay, Representative Hansen, you have the second bill, which is House File 3259, and the motion is to lay House File 3259 over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Bill. So, Representative Hansen, please explain your bill.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, and thank you again, my fellow committee members. I appreciate the time this morning. So 3259 is a technical bill that actually corrects two parts of changes we made last year. So as you heard earlier, we changed our law to allow counties and tribes to collect information that was missing from MFIP household reports last year. And however, the change was made in 256J, but it didn't get to 256P. And so this part of the bill seeks to correct that. The second part of 3259 seeks to align some statutes. 256P01 subdivision 3 defines income as income and payments from services, service and rehabilitation programs that meet or exceed the state's minimum wage rate as earned income. And that it shouldn't be counted towards eligibility. But 256P06 defines it as unearned income and subject to a minimum wage calculation. And so this contradiction needs to be corrected so that there's consistency in the statute, and this bill seeks to do just that. So I will turn it back over to Madam Chair. And again, Deborah Schlick is here to answer any technical questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Do we have any questions from members for Ms. Schlick? I'm not seeing any questions. Any final comments, Representative Hansen?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. These are just two slight technical changes that will make sure we can give clear and concise information to counties and tribes, and I appreciate your support in getting these changed. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Hansen. So House File 3259 is laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Policy Omnibus Bill. Okay, with that, members, we will be meeting on Tuesday, February 22nd. We will have a slate of bills, so check the agenda and the posting. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Have a great day.